Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. 21 minutes after 7. As I said to you before the 7 o'clock news, joining us in studio, a gentleman who we've had on numerous occasions. We've discussed all kinds of things. Let's welcome back to our program, Vasan Bharat. Good morning to you and welcome to our program.
Good morning, Satish. Thanks for having me again and welcome to all of your listeners this morning.
We're here to discuss agriculture and the budget, but there's so much more that we will discuss, obviously, that's for sure. Agriculture, would I be correct to describe agriculture as the bastard child of budgets gone by? And can we expect much more of the same moving forward? We've had numerous discussions on the issue of agriculture. We actually have a program dedicated on the station about agriculture more than once a week. I've spoken to various groups, the Agricultural Society, farmers groups, and everybody else. And they are not necessarily pleased, and that's putting it mildly, with the state of the agriculture sector in this country. You are a Minister of Agriculture under the People's Partnership, and I not cautiously, not guardedly, but openly say that everyone that I've spoken to, as they've described you, as probably one of the best agriculture ministers we've ever seen. And maybe that's because of some of the things you did, your understanding of the sector. Let's go back before we go forward. And during that time period when you were Minister of Agriculture, there was something that you were able to achieve. The agriculture sector was in a certain state and you were able to move it from one point to another. What were some of the challenges? What were some of the things that you had done back then?
So, as we were just discussing off air, Satish, and I say it openly, I could have tape recorded this conversation 7 years or 8 years ago and sent it to you, and I'd be saying exactly the same thing today as I did then.
Mm-hmm.
The problems in the agriculture sector dates back decades. And they're really primarily the same issues. The issues of water, either too much water or too little water, drought or flooding. The issue of infrastructure for being provided in terms of access roads and also ponds. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in detail. Financing costs, as you know, without collateral, farmers can't get funding. So, for example, because they don't have leases on their lands in the majority of cases, they're unable to go to the bank and get financing. So in the majority of cases, most farmers have funded their operations, send their children to school, build their homes, built a life on cash because they've had no option to go to the bank and get funding. You have the issue of gluts in the market where, for example, if a farmer overproduces, which is something we would want to do, you would find other people, if there's too much tomatoes in the market, and you've seen it all the time, the price of tomatoes will drop to, you know, £4 for $10, where the cost of production might be $5 a pound. So the farmer is losing money. It's best for his, and better in a lot of cases for them to just leave it in the field. You have, of course, the long-standing problem of pradial larceny, which we're yet to attack with a methodical approach. And of course, you have this issue of security of tenure, where farmers have been waiting in some cases 30, 40 years to get their leases. And unfortunately, in many cases, they just abandon because without security of tenure, without the leases, they can't even access the incentives that the government offers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a difficult and horrible situation to be in for farmers. And what we attempted to do is back in 2010, what we did in the first instance was we said, look, this is clearly not working. It is clear that the public servants didn't understand what the farmers' needs and requirements were. And so the first thing that we did, and I think it was within the first maybe 2 or 3 months of me being minister, we pulled in the representatives of 86 farmers' groups from across the country. So we wanted to be as representative as we could of farmers' groups spread across the country. And we had a workshop in South. I don't remember the name of the hotel. Something by the Sea. TJ's by the Sea or something. And we had all of these farmers' groups in that one-day thing. And I was there with them from 8 o'clock in the morning till about 7, 8 o'clock at night. And what we said was, listen, I want you to tell us, what are your five biggest challenges that confront you on a daily basis as a farmer and have been confronting you? And then after lunch, what we did was we said, okay, I want you to tell us in your own words, how do we overcome these things? So that resulted in a brochure that I have here, actually, which is still up on the ministry's website. It's called the National Food Production Action Plan 2012 to 2015, Agriculture Now. And what we then did with that exercise is that we did it in draft and we sent it back to the farmers groups and we said, listen, is this what we discussed? And are these the issues that you've been confronted with, and are these the solutions you're recommending? And together with the ministry, we put together this brochure. And what we were able to do is to get the farmers buy-in to all of the things that were in this book now, because this was no longer a document written in the halcyon walls of the Ministry of Agriculture in St. Clair and then handed down to these farmers. This was a working document that they participated in and they built themselves. So they felt a sense of pride, but I think more importantly, they felt a sense of belonging, that for the first time they actually had a voice. And that made it very easy for me to do the work that we needed to do subsequently. So when I stood up in Parliament in 2010 and I said, listen, these are the things we're going to do. And I said, we're going to build X number of ponds. We're going to build do X number of access roads. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. Of course, the other side laughed at me. But the following year, I was able to stand up and I said, last year we said we would build 200 retention ponds. We've now built 350. Last year we said we would build do 150 kilometers of access roads. We've done 300 kilometers of access roads, and I highlighted all of the areas of concern. In fact, with the issues of security of tenure, I took a significant amount of leases outside of the ministry, outside of the Attorney General's office, and I sent it to private attorneys who were prepared to accept us. Because remember, these things are just a template. This is no big set of work. This is a template that you're just renewing a lease. So we got lawyers who were prepared to work, who were prepared to do the leases privately for, you know, an insignificant amount of money. And so that also kind of speeded up the delivery of leases. We had ADB with vans going out giving out microloans. So instead of people having to come to Port of Spain, we opened an office in Chaguanas, as well as we had these vans going across the rural, mostly rural areas in Trinidad, talking to people about the loans and giving them loans. In fact, we started to give loans based on the value of your crop, so you didn't have to put up collateral, ahead of time. So we did a lot of things that I think more than just the facilitation of what the ministry was offering, it gave the farmers a sense of pride that for the first time they were actually involved in a lot of what was going on and they were a part of it. And I think that helped to a large extent. I mean, one of the things you might remember is we negotiated with KFC to get sweet potato fries into KFC. Mm-hmm. So in 2012, I was able to negotiate with my public servants an agreement with KFC whereby seven of the KFC stores, in those days they only had 16 stores, but in the first instance, there would be a trial that seven of the KFC stores would take sweet potato fries. And what we were trying to do was to change the palate of the consumer, because we felt if we were able to get it into popular stores and in popular areas, like KFC, we would be able to begin to change the palate of the consumer. So the children who were buying KFC would now go home and tell their parents they want sweet potato fries instead of wanting potato fries. Because, of course, we don't grow potatoes here, but we grow sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. And then we also embarked on a program in the schools. We started to go to all of the schools, secondary schools primarily, and start to talk to them about, first of all, agriculture, start to talk to them about changing the palate, but in a different way, in a more simplified way, taking sweet potato and cassava fries to hand out, to give to them. And so we started a whole exercise where we wanted to change the pattern of consumption in Trinidad and Tobago. For example, I banned at the Ministry of Agriculture, at any event we had, I banned any imported food being used. So my staff used to go ahead, if we had something even at the Hilton and we were entertaining, and so they would go ahead and make sure there was no apples for dessert, or there would be no apple in the salad, or as thing as that. And it was sending a message from the top that there was a focus on everything local, we launched a huge buy local campaign, made people proud about what we were doing. So it was a, it was not just one thing, it was several things, but it led to a cascading effect where the farmers themselves felt empowered and they felt that they had a champion who was actually who trusted them and actually gave them a voice at the table.
Yeah.
And that's really what it was.
And as I said, you know, we've had the discussions and you hear farmers still refer to that time and they refer to some of the work that was done. And, well, I'm not too sure what happened from 2015 moving on. I don't know if you have any idea as to what transpired, but that's a discussion for another time. At this stage, we have an agriculture sector that can possibly do so much more, but are faced with numerous challenges, mounting challenges. One of the most recent is crime. We have seen farmers be victims in the most brutal manners. People in the field, which is, you would expect a farmer working hard in the field to be safe, but they are now targets. And we spoke to farmers, a farmers group from Jerningham and the Agricultural Society, and they are saying that, that crime has started affecting the industry so much that there are farmers who no longer want to be a part of the industry, that's one. And there are farmers now who are thinking of expensive ways to protect themselves, hiring security, and that's going to have a trickle-down effect on the price of commodities, the availability of commodities as well. What's your take on this latest development?
Well, crime is all-pervasive, right? It's affecting everything. It's affecting not just agriculture, but it's affecting small and medium-sized businesses. It's affecting citizens generally. It's affecting the way we now live our lives, really, because we have now become very reclusive, many of us. We have very few leisure activities. I can tell you that I very rarely ever go out at all, unless I'm going to somebody's house. I very rarely ever go out. So it's affecting our way of life in Trinidad and Tobago. But again, when you, and it's like, it's like everything else in life, and we were discussing just now, if you went, if the owners of this radio station decided tomorrow morning they're going to go out and pick up the first person on the pavement and say, let's, Henna, I want you to go and do Satish's program.
Right.
It would be an absolute failure because you, the person doesn't have the skill set to be able to conduct a program in the manner which you are able to because of your abilities and your experience and your qualifications to do the job. And similarly, what we do is when we hire career politicians who really, in many instances, have never had a real job in their life, they're just career politicians. They've never really worked in the real world. And just to give you a throwback to the agriculture sector, just to link it, when I joined the ministry, my public servants had never been out on a, on an, in a farm or a field or anything. So when I, every time I went out, 2 and 3 times a week, they would go with me from my public servants down, from my permanent secretary down. So for the first time, they actually experienced what mud was and being in mud and flooding, and they actually experienced how hard farmers' hands were when they shook their hands for the first time, the reality of what life a farmer had and the experiences. And they actually experienced farmers crying, breaking down and crying in front of us. So when we went back and we wrote this document, the National Food Action Plan, it wrote it, it, they wrote it with a different context and a different mindset, because for the first time, they had experienced what real farmers were going through. So when you pick up people and you put them in positions and they have no real experience of virtually not just the specific area in which they're working, but they have no experience of anything outside of being a career parliamentarian, a career politician, then these are the outcomes you're going to get, unfortunately. And it's not just in crime, it's all across the board, right?
Well,
so this issue of farmers, we come back to them, of course, being afraid and for their lives and so on. It's a genuine one. In fact, some farmers from Kunjal and Barakpur reached out to me about a year ago, and I met with them. I went down to Barakpur and I met with them, and we were able to put some things in place. For example, I was able to get the then commissioner of police involved in arranging for them to at least have provisional firearm licenses, as well as I was able to get the police station in Barakpur to put these guys on a WhatsApp chat so that with the police station, so that they were able to alert directly the police station when they had problems. I was also able to get the police station there to do regular patrols with these farmers. And believe it or not, and these were the very same farmers, they were on a TV6 interview 2 or 3 weeks prior to me meeting with them. And a couple of them had been, had their farms had been raided. And then when they started staying overnight in the farms to protect the farms, they were beaten and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, a few months later, after we'd put this program in place, being proactive, and I met one of the guys, and I asked him how things were going. He said they'd had absolutely no crime in the area since this mechanism had been put in place. Now, it's not rocket science, but it requires focus. Now, criminals will move to easy targets. So if you put something in place where they figure, now, hang on a second, I'm likely to get caught, or it's going to be harder for me to get to the whatever I'm going to steal, they go somewhere else. So I'm not saying we should transfer the problem or elsewhere, but the point I'm making is that if you focus on the issue, then criminals would have less opportunity to be able to conduct their affairs. And that's what we did in agriculture. We focused on the issues that were important. I'm not gonna sit here and tell you that we were able to tackle everything, but certainly we made a major start in tackling the major problems and one would hope. You see, if you stay in something long enough, unfortunately I was only there for 2 years, as you know, but if you stay in something long enough, you create a culture that's almost irreversible. Right? Because it becomes normalized.
Yeah, and you moved into trade and investment, which is another area that we should probably talk about as well, because we've been having a discussion about the investments or lack thereof in this country and what that means for our economy, for our progress, for our development, for our citizens and jobs and everything else. For those of you now joining our conversation, we are speaking this morning with former Government Minister Vasan Bharat. Welcome back. Our special guest this morning, former Trade and Investment Minister, former Agriculture Minister under the People's Partnership, Vasan Bharat. Take a couple of your calls, 627-3223, 625-2257. Let's see who's with us. Nobody there. Try us back. 627-3223, 625-2257. As we wait for some calls before we went to the break. Oh, I think we have somebody here. Let's see. Hello, good morning.
Satish, good morning, and good morning to Mr. Bharat. Mr. Bharat, I heard a very sad story a couple of days ago. A gentleman decided to put down 1,000 pawpaw trees. They were doing well. They flourished, he nourished them and everything else. Everything was going fine. He came back a couple of days later and he realized that there were no pawpaw on any of the trees. He instructed his workers to cut down every tree because it did not make any sense. Now, PDL asked me really and truly a serious matter. And when you are purchasing something from someone, you know they didn't just come from Norris during a rain market, okay? And they don't have land of their own. Why do you purchase it? Because the consumer end up purchasing these things either in the market, supermarket, whatever it is. So do you have some question that bedevil us? Because I believe to myself, even right now, with the abundance of ex-carrying workers' land that remain unattended, what we ought to do is move from a situation of having only shortcuts on those land to allow persons to plant things like breadfruit, bread nut, and all those different things on the land, because after all, they're not going to tend that and it doesn't need much tending. But the question of PDL asking is really and truly a serious one. But we must find the people who are stealing these things, selling them, and reselling them. So I listen to your comments.
Well, unless we apprehend the people who are stealing them in the first place, and then others are looking on and seeing that it's quite easy to make a buck by stealing the sweat of other people, then clearly we're going to continue to have this problem. So I think in the initial instance, we're not going to encourage farmers to grow when they have no protection. When they call the police, there's no police vehicle. And then I have to be honest with you, we don't take Prader last in this country as a serious crime, and that's the biggest problem, because we have so many other more heinous issues and crimes to deal with that Prader larceny occupies a very low spot on the pecking order as far. And I can't blame the police per se, because if they're having to deal with murder and rape and robberies and home invasions and so on, clearly the issue of Prader larceny is quite low on their radar, and that's our problem in Trinidad and Tobago. So if we are interested in encouraging agriculture, we can't throw our hands up as a government or as a country and say, well, we'll let the farmers deal with that themselves, because clearly they're not going to do it.
Take another call. Hello, good morning.
Hello and good morning. Morning, Mr. Barrett.
Morning.
But I would like to know, Mr. Barrett, do you think the PRM is taking the country in the right direction, put around this country in 2 years? My answer to that is no. And what is your opinion on, I think the government from this budget presently, they should spend some money allocation to start the refinery. What's your opinion, sir? Have a good day.
Well, I think we are in a situation where there's a crisis of confidence in Trinidad and Tobago. And the Minister of Finance continues to see the budget as a balancing exercise, an accounting exercise, a bookkeeping exercise, rather than an exercise that reallocates resources based on social and economic priorities to create a level of stability and then, of course, prosperity and growth. And that's the issue, because he's essentially a bookkeeper, because he doesn't have the skill set to have the vision to be in a position to create growth for the country. And we've seen that based on the failed policies in the last 8 years, failed policies of taxation, borrowing, selling of state assets, and of course dipping into the Heritage and Stabilization Fund. And that has resulted in the last 8 years in zero or minimal growth, less than 1% in most cases. In fact, the only time we had growth was last year. And let's be very frank about this, that growth, that increase in revenues is purely based on the, not on our sweat, not on our in achievements or endeavors, but on the blood of the Ukrainian soldiers and Russian soldiers and their civilians. So that's the only reason that we've had an uptick in our revenue streams. I don't think that this government has, if they've not been able to show in 8 years that they have a vision for the country, and if in 8 years, when other countries are showing significant growth rates the citizens are enjoying a much better quality of life. I don't think if after 8 years they've not been able to do it, I don't think they're likely to do it after this budget.
Hello, good morning.
A pleasant good morning, once more, Satish. A pleasant good morning, Mr. Barrett. How are you?
Morning, I'm fine, thank you.
Mr. Barrett, you will recall that when agriculture was one of the main revenue streams in Trinidad, we never suffered from foreign exchange and we never had a huge unemployment problem. You will remember that. And I raised that issue with Satish maybe last week. And I hope that the budget will focus on agriculture, because it will create employment for the unemployed. It will provide food for the nation. It can provide food, export products and so on. And we can gain foreign exchange and it can help quite a lot. Mr. Barrett, if you were to become the Minister of Agriculture once more, would you encourage the reintroduction of sugarcane, cocoa and coffee, and other products that we exported in the past? I thank you, enjoy.
Thank you so much for your call. That's an interesting question.
Well, just to put it in context, I mean, we have destroyed a lot of our agricultural sector. I mean, the sugarcane industry has been destroyed. So you basically have to start from scratch if you're going to do that. And certainly the technology that's available to us today will allow us to actually get back into sugarcane, but in a more mechanized manner. So just give you an example. I've just come back from Fiji. Fiji crushed 1 million tons of cane last year. 1 million tons of cane Fiji crushed last year. Fiji is a small country, 980,000 people. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things I was saying to Satish off air, I was having lunch with the Deputy Prime Minister, and he was telling me all the great things. Fiji's growth rate last year was 15.4%. Agriculture represents 10.4%, 10.5% of their GDP. Their tourism sector, although they don't have anything in comparison, they might disagree, but they have nothing in comparison to what we have here in terms of our beaches and so on. And then I asked him, I said, and what's the murder rate in Fiji? And he looked at me, he says, Vasant, why are you asking me that? I said, but I just wanted to know. He said, it's zero. I said, zero? He said, yes. I said, nobody's been murdered in Fiji this year. He said, no, it's zero. So we continue to compare when ministers stand on a podium. We are always compared with the worst in the world. We are always saying, you know, we are better off than this one, we're better off than that one. But we never compare ourselves with the best in the world. And that's a major problem that we have in Trinidad and Tobago. But I also come back to the issue of cocoa. We've been talking about cocoa for the longest while, and I'll give you a simple, a basic experience I had many years ago when I was involved with the ministry, and we were promoting Trinidad and Tobago cocoa at a world fair. And our delegation, it was a small delegation, and this is a world fair we were at in France, And nobody was taking us on because they didn't know who we were. There's a little, you know, group of four or five of us who were there. And eventually somebody found out that we were from Trinidad. And all of a sudden, the entire dynamics of the fair changed because everybody started following us because everybody wanted Trinidad cocoa. And in fact, many of the large chocolatiers who were there, they wanted to see, to understand how they could invest in Trinidad and Tobago, because that was the only way they could get, they could boost the agricultural production of cocoa. And one of the large chocolatiers who we met was a French chocolatier. Just to be able to see that they had Trinidad chocolate, Trinidad cocoa in their chocolate bar, they actually they had 10% because that was all they could have afforded to put in it because of the scarcity of the product. They had just to be able to see they used Trinidad chocolate. Trinidad cocoa, they had a content in their content 10% of
and they saw that as a positive.
They saw that as a major selling point. As a major selling point.
That is so, interesting.
So the point is that with the necessary focus and expertise and understanding what to do, these things are not, it's not rocket science, but you need the skill set, and you need people who understand what's required to lead these transitions through, and you need to have people who can keep their foot on the accelerator until these things become normal, so they cannot be reversed.
In 2014, I had the opportunity to visit Jamaica, and while there, I met a gentleman who's in charge of a company that's regional in nature, huge, really really big, and the conversations obviously went to the economy and what's going on in Trinidad and all that kind of thing, and he asked a question that I don't think we as a nation we've gotten an answer to. He asked, what does Trinidad and Tobago have that the rest of the world wants? Aside from oil and gas, what else do you have? And if you sit and you ponder that in your decision-making as to what do we have so much. We really do. Mm-hmm. A simple thing like ecotourism, which is the buzz when it comes to tourism. People are looking for experiences outside of the sand and sea and sitting in our hotel the entire day. We have so much to offer here. But is it being packaged in a manner? Is it being sold to the right people? We sell Ahsoka on the seas on our cruise ship trying to sell Carnival to 400,000 or much other people on the cruise ship or whatever else. And it seems as though, unless it's Carnival related, we don't think we have anything the rest of the world wants. You just highlighted that companies are proud to put that they have 10% of Trinidad cocoa in their chocolates because they see that as a selling point. We obviously don't see it that way here at home, or at least the decision makers, the people who are in charge of charting, maybe what do we need to do to change that? You've been in the system, you've experienced some of the change while you were there. I mean, even the local markets, supplying the local markets for farmers might have been out of their reach normally. I remember having a discussion with someone who was related to a very large fast food chain, and they said that they had to import pineapples at one point in time because they just couldn't get the demand satisfied locally. And the man was talking about containers of pineapple. And I don't know what the situation is with that at this point in time. Is it doable? Can we get it turned around to the point where we don't have a food import bill of billions of dollars? Costa Rica, I remember, had some economic challenges. And the government invested in small farmers and turned the economy around.
Yeah.
They were able to do it mostly because the farmers were growing what people wanted to eat. So they satisfied their local demand first, and then they had so much extra that they were able to now export some of these things. I think we're getting is avocados or something we're getting from Costa Rica in a huge way. Can we get it done? Or is it pie in the sky thinking?
No, we can get it done. And I know that story of the pineapple issue. In fact, you may remember that, and I know the fast food. In fact, I was having a discussion with the CEO of that organization, and this is how the thing came about, because we were chatting about pizzas, and he said, you know, you wouldn't believe me, Vasant, that pineapples is the biggest selling topping on pizzas. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised, I was shocked. And I said, but where do you get your pineapples from? He says, everything comes in from Miami. And I think it was like a container every month of pineapples coming in. And I said, why don't you buy pineapples in Trinidad? Because we grew pineapples in abundance in Tableland, and you see these fellas selling pineapples on the street all the time. And he said, I'd be happy to discuss it, but I don't want to have to deal with individual people because of the issues and so on. And so I took it upon myself to go down to Tableland, meet with the pineapple farmers, 50 of them, to try to get them together in some kind of cooperative that could supply this particular, this group. with pineapples. Of course, I was accused of, at the time I was accused, of campaigning with Gypsy at the time. But anyway, that's it. You know, these things really don't deter me because they're irrelevant, quite frankly. But coming back to your issue of how we do it, coming out of the National Food Production Plan, it wasn't just that in isolation. What we did was we developed this brochure called Investment Opportunities in Agriculture. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually highlighted. So if you went to anything here, right, it told you, like, let's say you went to I'm going to just pull up something here. And this hopefully is still available in the ministry because a lot of work went into it. So if you just say, and in fact, we highlighted all the different products. We had rice, we had cassava, we had sweet potato and so on. So let's take sweet potato. We did an industry overview of what the production levels were, what we felt by 2015 we would. So we were saying that we would have taken sweet potato production from 3,150 tons, which was in 2012, to 13,090 tons by 2015, right? And that was a 300% growth and blah, blah, blah. We also then went on to say what the market was, where the market was, where the export and investment opportunities were for these farmers, and how you would go ahead by, what would you do if you wanted to get into processing and agro-processing. So for example, we said for processing, it could be fresh cut, it'd be frozen products like fries, cubes, slices, purees, snacks and cereals, bakery products. So we were able to tie what we were doing with the Food Action Plan to another brochure that talked about investment opportunities. So we were actually hand-holding the entire process from A to Z. We didn't just say, look, there's a document, you all go ahead and do it. Mm. We were hand-holding the process. Now, we didn't, obviously, you don't expect everyone to be successful, but you do expect a group of people to rise from that and be able to take up the challenge once you hand-hold the process. But if you only give them a part of the puzzle and you let them get, and you say, all right, go ahead and you do what you want. Like, for example, there's incentives on the books in the Ministry of Agriculture. Most people can't access the incentives.
Yeah.
Right?
I know that. Are you able to stay with us for a bit after?
Yeah,
the,
sure.
Okay, okay, okay. Because I really want to get into the investments. And when we speak of agriculture, I don't know how many people consider the manufacturing possibilities. And that's where the real money is. Because anytime we talk agriculture, people feel, well, you need to take your produce and build a shed on the side of the road and sell it to people by the pound. But there is so much more. I remember having a discussion about hot pepper. And about the hot peppers that we produce and the pepper sauce industry. I saw a feature on Tabasco and how huge Tabasco is, and pepper sauce and the pepper crush, which is used in many other applications other than just food. The potential is there. We have one of the hottest peppers in the world, this Moruga scorpion pepper thing, that we have not capitalized on. The discussion we had some time ago was a pound of this scorpion pepper was selling for like about 10 US or some kind of thing like that. A 50 pound bag of pepper was valued as so much more than a barrel of oil. And the demand for it is there. And it's just sad that we haven't capitalized on some of these things. But we'll get to that and a lot more. We'll take some more of your calls on the other side of it as we continue our discussion with former Agriculture Minister, former Trade and Investment Minister, Vasan Bharat.
This is the Morning Rumble with Satish Mahabir.
Three minutes after eight, the final hour of our show. We've got two other interviews for you a little later on. Continue our discussion for a bit with former Agriculture, former Trade and Investment Minister Vasan Bharat. Let's take one or two more of your calls before we get back into our discussion. Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Satish.
Good morning to you.
Good morning to your honored guest, Mr. Bharat, and listeners, Princess Song. Mr. Bharat, on behalf of the farmers of this country and their families, I want to thank you for your effort and your contribution and your successes in the Ministry of Agriculture. Because when we talk in agriculture, we're not just talking about tomatoes and baigan, you know. We are talking about life, food, nutrition, food security at a time when the world is in dangerous volatility. food is a critical factor here now, and any politician or government that is not talking about food, or food is not placed probably number one on the agenda, is a criminal. I am saying that. Food must be number one item on our agenda nowadays. And Mr. Barrett, you made a very good point. Your successes, what was really the secret in it? Because you have made a point about experience, politicians having experience and expertise and so on and so on. And I agree with that. If we do not have people who have knowledge and skills and expertise in various fields and so on, we will never get the outcomes we want. And that is why this country will continue to fall and fail in the abyss of crime and poverty and destitution and corruption. Because we have incompetent 41 members in parliament. They don't care. Yes, they might be good platform speakers and they follow the leader and they are loyal. But they don't have the skills of governance and management. Management is a key factor here. Mr. Barrett, I would like to hear your thoughts. Thank you very much, Princess Song.
Thank you for your call. The issue of management.
Well, in any field of endeavor, leadership and management play a key role in the success of the organization. And, you know, if you take somebody who's unqualified, that person becomes a member of parliament, and then that person subsequently becomes a minister of government, and that person has never really worked in the real world, then clearly the outcome you're going to get is a very negative one. And that's unfortunately the situation that we face in Trinidad and Tobago and have been facing for decades. It's not a now problem, right? It's a problem that has caused us for decades to now be in a situation where basically all of our institutions of state have been decimated. Mm. I don't think there's any institution of state, when I call institution of state, I'm talking about, you know, organizations like the NIB and WASA and License Office and customer-facing organizations. I don't think any of them are currently delivering the quality of goods and services for which they were set up. In fact, they are a long way short of it, and in many instances, it comes across almost that they're doing the citizen a favor for delivering the good or service to the citizen, and that's where we've reached. Now, it is my view, having worked in many jurisdictions across the world and having read extensively on this issue, that politicians like to have, and I'm talking about insecure politicians, they like to have weak institutions. Because if you have weak institutions, then you have to go to a politician for a favor because the institutions aren't working effectively or efficiently. And it's my view that in Trinidad and Tobago, we like to have weak institutions, because then if you have strong, vibrant working institutions, it doesn't really matter which government is in, which party is in office, these institutions will continue to work in the favor of the citizens of the country, continuing to deliver high quality goods and services.
Speaking about what's best for the country, we've seen the discussion, well, we've heard and we've seen some of the reports on this country when it comes to investments,
yeah,
and direct foreign investments, and what that means. I think there was a story sometime that said that we had a negative figure when it comes to investments, and people couldn't understand what's going on there. So, as a former minister of trade and investment, there would have been objectives and goals. There would have been things that you would have achieved. You, I'm sure, would be monitoring what has been going on since you're no longer in that office. In your opinion, where are we at this point in time when it comes to foreign investments and those helping us, if we have any at all?
Well, what you were referring to just now was that in 2022, there was a UNDP report that showed that Trinidad and Tobago had negative foreign direct investment, if that's possible, of $498 million, which meant essentially there was a flight of capital outside of Trinidad. There was more money leaving Trinidad and Tobago than actually entering our shores.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't changed very much since then. And our reality is that there is a lack of confidence in the market. Now, remember, money is very mobile. A lot of our politicians don't realize that. But money is very mobile, whereby local investors are looking at ensuring two things. One, they get the best returns on their investment, and that their investment is, at least the capital part of it, is safe. So they're looking at what's called a risk-reward ratio. What's going to give them the biggest reward for the least amount of risk? And it's not just Trinidadian investors, it's investors all around the world. So when you're looking at it, making a of taking your money out of the bank and putting it into an investment, you're going to look at the you're going to look at the country that gives you the best investment climate for that investment dollar. Trinidad and Tobago, with the issues of crime, with the issues of ease of doing business, because it's a real headache to have to deal with customs and to deal with the ports and to have to deal with the Bureau of Standards and to have to deal with chemistry, food and drug. It is a huge issue, and it's additional costs involved for the end user as a direct result, because all of those things add on costs to the cost of doing business. So when a potential investor, either foreign or local, looks at all of those obstacles in his or her way, then Trinidad and Tobago is not a friendly investment place. It's not a place to do business. And then, of course, the bureaucracy involved at ministerial levels and so on to get certain permits and so on is it is more than pulling teeth to do business in Trinidad and Tobago. And people will go where it's easier and simpler to do business. And that's why there has been no foreign direct investment outside of the energy sector, of course. And in fact, even then, we've only just seen that three bid rounds have been signed, I think, earlier this week. And let me, as I talk about that, let me just say a little bit about this big fuss that's being caused with regard to the signing of the deal with Venezuela on the on Dragon Gas. I want people to understand one thing, and I know the minister is going to make a big meal of it, beat his chest up in the budget on Monday. What Trinidad and Tobago signed is a cooperation agreement. Okay, that is like an MOU. It means absolutely nothing. Until you have a contract and until you have a term sheet that lays out the terms of that contract, you have nothing. So let's not be fooled and let's not be misled and let's not be jumping up in the streets now, because an MOU and a cooperation agreement is completely different to signing a contract to deliver oil within a specific or gas within a specific time frame.
Yeah, we need to wrap up because we do have two other interviews before we're finished at nine. So that's quite a timetable.
And just to quickly finish off with regard to ease of doing business. That was one of the first things we tackled when I became minister, because I understood how important the ease of doing business was to creating a business-friendly environment and to make it easy to do business. And as a result, we moved the ease of doing business indicator from 88 to 62 in the space of 18 months. And in fact, early 2015, Trinidad and Tobago was rated by the World Bank as one of the top 10 reformers in the world in ease of doing business. And that letter is still with the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Trade, based on the work that we did.
Yeah, we had that discussion earlier this week. And we had the discussion with Dr. Shane Mohammed because we were talking about the politics of economics. And he actually, I think he said he sat on some committee at the point in time. But I remember having that interview with you during when it was taking place. And I remember how proud you were of the time frame within 2 days or 3 days to get a business.
I'm getting shivers thinking about that. Yeah, no, really, seriously. But because when people think that you say these things, that is impossible. Oh, you can do that, this, that. With the right focus and the necessary leadership and expertise, we could turn this place around in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, that's a level of optimism not many people share, I can tell you that. But let's look to Monday.
Yeah.
I don't want to say your predictions, but what are some of the things you expect us to see come Monday?
A lot of boasting and beating up the chest about Dragon Gas, a lot about getting inflation under control. I don't know, there's nothing that... Oh, they'll talk about... the favorable report from Standard & Poor's and Moody's. And let me just say again, put that in context for those who may not understand. All the Standard & Poor's and Moody's reports were able to basically point it to was that the government can pay its debts.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it does. And what that did, whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, was allow the government to now go back to the international market within a few weeks and go and borrow $560 million. Now, they're boasting that it was three times oversubscribed, but let's put that in context again. It was only three times oversubscribed because of the interest rate which they offered, which was 5.95%, which is above the market rate.
Right.
So you can earn 4% on US Treasuries, but if you can earn 5.9% on government-backed sovereign bonds, then you'll take 5.95% because you can't get it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly you're going to be oversubscribed. So there's nothing to boast about. Had we offered what's the market rate at 4%, we would have not gotten anything at all. So, you know, we need to start thinking about what this government has to offer to us, and in my opinion, has very little. It's done nothing in 8 years. In fact, we've regressed significantly the last 8 years in almost every sector I can think about. I don't think the government has anything to boast about. What I would like to see and what I'm likely to see are two completely different things.
Yeah. Now, we're going to have to leave our interview here. I'm sure that after the budget presentation, we'll have more discussions and we'll have you back in.
That'd be my
Always
pleasure.
My pleasure having you on, ladies and
Thank
gentlemen.
You.
This is where we drop the curtains on our interview with our guest, Vasant Bharat. Some messages. We've got another interview, JMMB, coming up right after this. Stay with us.